but it wasn't hard to guess where the money went. He didn't ask me my name, or rather, he only asked the name I wanted. Birth date, address, license or ID, did I want to be an organ donor? As we talked, we walked into the library to give us an excuse to be quiet, and when he reached a banner with a swath of clean white, he stood me up against it and took my picture. I'd taken extra care before coming to the library to meet him, even bought some makeup, so I knew I could pull off 19. It's about the eyes, really. If you've seen enough, you just look older, no matter what the rest of your face looks like. He told me to meet him at a particular hot dog cart that evening and he'd have what I needed. When we reconvened, he was late again. He held up an envelope. Such a little thing, really, but it's enough to change a life. He told me it would be a grand, but he'd knock it down to 500 if I slept with him. I paid him the grand. He walked away in one direction and I in another, and when I got back to the hostel where I planned to spend the night, a good ways from the soup kitchen and anyone who might remember a girl being told about illegal papers, I opened the envelope and got my first good look at Inara Morrissey.
"Why didn't you want to be found?" he asks, using a pen to stir the creamer into his coffee. "I wasn't worried about being found. To be found, someone has to be looking for you." "Why wouldn't anyone be looking for you?" "I miss New York. No one asks these kinds of questions there." Static crackles in his ear as one of the techs opens a line. "New York says she got her GED 3 years ago, passed with flying colors, but never registered for the SAT or asked for the scores to be passed on to a college or employer." "Did you drop out of high school?" he asks. "Or did you get your GED so you wouldn't have to produce a diploma?" "Now that you have a name, it's much easier to dig into my life, isn't it?" She finishes off the cake and sets the plastic fork at a neat angle across the plate, the tines down. Paper crinkles as she tears open one of the sugar packets and empties it into a pile on the plate. Licking the only fingertip not covered in gauze and tape, she presses it against the sugar and sticks it into her mouth. "That only tells you about New York, though." "I know, so I need you to tell me about what came before." "I liked being Inara." "But that isn't who you are," he says gently. An anger flashes through her eyes. Gone just as fast as her almost smiles or her surprise, but they're just the same. "So a rose by any other name isn't still a rose?" "That's language, not identity. Who you are isn't a name, but it is a history, and I need to know yours." "Why? My history doesn't tell you about the gardener, and isn't that what it's really about? The gardener and his garden, all his butterflies?" "And if he survives to come to trial, we need to provide the jury with credible witnesses. A young woman who won't even tell the truth about her name doesn't cut it."
"It's just a name."
"Not if it's yours." That not-quite-smile twists her lips briefly.
"Bliss said that."
"Bliss?"
Lionette stood outside the tattoo room, as ever, her eyes politely averted from me until I could put on the slinky black dress that had become my only piece of clothing.
"Close your eyes," she told me. "Let's take this in stages."
I'd kept my eyes closed so long in that room that the thought of being voluntarily blind again made my skin crawl. But Lionette had done well by me so far, and she'd clearly done this before for other girls. I made the choice to trust her a bit further. Once I closed my eyes, she took my hand and led me down the hall in the opposite direction than we usually went. It was a long hallway, and we turned left at the end of it. I kept my right hand out against the glass walls, my arm flopping free whenever we passed one of the open doorways. Then she directed me through one of the doorways and positioned me where she wanted, with gentle hands on my upper arms. I felt her step back.
Open your eyes.
She stood in front of me, off-center in a room nearly identical to mine. This one had small personal touches. Origami creatures on a shelf above the bed, sheets and blankets and pillows, pumpkin-colored curtains hiding the toilet, sink, and shower from sight. The edge of a book stuck out from under the largest pillow, and drawers lined the space under the bed.
What name did he give you?
Maya. I staved off the shudder that came from saying it aloud for the first time, from the memory of him saying it over and over while he...
Maya, she repeated, and gave me another sound to hold on to. Take a look at yourself now, Maya.
She held up a mirror, positioning it so I could use it to look into another mirror behind me. Large portions of my back were still pink and raw and swollen around the fresh ink, which I knew was darker than it would become once the scabs flaked off. Fingerprints were visible on my sides where the fabric gapped, but there was nothing to obscure the design. It was ugly and terrible and lovely. The upper wings were golden brown, tawny like lionette's hair and eyes, flecked through with bits of black, white, and deep bronze. The lower wings were shades of rose and purple, also marked through with patterns of black and white. The detail was astonishing, slight color variations giving the impressions of individual scales. The colors were rich, almost saturated, and they filled almost my entire back, from the very tips of my shoulders to a little below the curve of my hips. The wings were tall and narrow, the outer edges just barely curving onto my sides. The artistry couldn't be denied. Whatever else he was, the gardener was talented. I hated it, but it was lovely. A head popped through the doorway, quickly followed by the rest of a tiny girl. She couldn't have topped 5 feet with her shoulders back, but no one could see those curves and think her a child. She had flawless, frosty white skin and huge blue-violet eyes, framed by a haphazardly pinned profusion of tight black curls. She was all striking contrasts, with a button nose that leaned toward cute rather than beautiful, but like all the girls I'd glimpsed in the garden, she was nothing less than stunning. Beauty loses its meaning when you're surrounded by too much of it.
So, this is a new girl.
She flopped down on the bed, hugging a small pillow to her chest.
What did the bastard name you?
He might hear you,
Lionette chided, but the girl on the bed just shrugged.
Let him. He's never asked us to love him. So what's he call you?
Maya, I said, in time with Lionette, and the word got a little less hard to hear. I wondered if it would continue to be that way, if in time the word wouldn't hurt at all, or if it was a tiny shard that always would. Like the piece of a splinter you can't reach with tweezers.
That's not too bad, then. Fucker named me Bliss.
She rolled her eyes and snorted.
Bliss? Do I look like a blissful person?
Oh, let's see. Her fingers made a twirling motion, and in that moment she reminded me a little of Hope. With that in mind, I slowly spun to show her my back.
Not too bad. The colors flatter you, anyway. We'll have to look up what kind that is.
It's a western pine elfin.
Lionette sighed. She shrugged at my sideways look.
It's something to do. Maybe it makes it a little less awful. I'm a lustrous copper.
I'm a Mexican blue wing,
added Bliss.
It's pretty enough. Awful, of course, but it's not like I have to look at it. Anyway, the name thing, he could call us A, B, or 3, and it wouldn't matter. Answer to it, but don't pretend it's somehow yours. Less confusing that way.
Less confusing?
Well, sure. Remember who you are, and then it's just playing a part. If you start to think of it as you, that's when the identity crisis hits. Identity crisis usually leads to a breakdown, and a breakdown around here leads to...
Bliss?
What? She seems like she can handle it. She isn't crying yet, and we all know what he does when the ink is finished.
Like Hope, but much smarter. So, what does a breakdown lead to?
Check the hallways. Just don't do it after you eat.
You'd just walk through the hallways, Victor reminds her. With my eyes closed? Then what was in the hallway? She swirls the remainder of the coffee in her mug rather than answer. giving him a look that suggests he should already know. Static crackles in his ear again.
Ramirez just called from the hospital, Edison says.
She's sending pictures of those the doctors expect to make it. Missing Persons has had some luck. Between them and the ones fresh in the morgue, they've got about half the girls identified. And we have a problem.
What kind of problem?
The girl looks at him sharply.
One of the girls they identified has some important family. She's still calling herself Ravenna, but her fingerprints match to Patrice Kingsley.
As in Senator Kingsley's missing daughter? Inara settles back in her chair, her expression clearly amused. Victor isn't sure what she finds funny about what promises to be a hell of a complication.
Has the senator been informed yet? He asks.
Not yet, answers Edison. Ramirez wanted to give us a heads up first. Senator Kingsley's been desperate to find her daughter, Vic. There isn't a chance in hell she won't push into the investigation.
And when that happens, any privacy they may be able to offer these girls will be out the window. Their faces will be plastered on every news network from here to the West Coast. And Inara, Victor rubs wearily at his eyes. If the senator learns they have any suspicions about this overly contained young woman, she won't rest until charges are filed.
Tell Ramirez to hold off as long as she can, he says finally. We need time. Roger.
Remind me how long she's been missing?
4.5 years.
4.5 years?
Ravenna,
Inara murmurs, and Victor stares at her.
No one ever forgets how long they've been there.
Why not?
It changes things, doesn't it? Having a senator involved.
It changes things for you as well.
Of course it does. How could it not?
She knows, he realizes uneasily. Maybe she doesn't know specifics, but she knows they suspect her of some kind of involvement. He measures the amusement in her eyes, the cynical twist to her mouth. She's a little too comfortable with this new information. Time to change the subject, then, before he loses the power in the room.
You said the girls in the apartment were your first friends.
She shifts slightly in her seat.
That's right,
she answers warily.
Why is that? Because I hadn't had any before?
Inara. She responds to that tone of voice the same way his daughters do, instinctively, grudgingly when she realizes it a moment too late, and just a bit sulky.
You're good at that. You have kids.
3 girls.
And yet you make a career in broken children.
In trying to rescue broken children, he corrects. In trying to get justice for broken children.
You really think broken children care about justice?
Wouldn't you?
Never really did, no. Justice is a faulty thing at the best of times, and it doesn't actually fix anything.
Would you say that if you'd gotten justice as a child? That not quite smile, bitter and gone too fast.
And what would I have needed justice for?
My life's work, and you think I won't recognize a broken child when she sits in front of me? She inclines her head to concede the point, and bites her lip and winces.
Not entirely accurate. Let's call me a shadow child, overlooked rather than broken. I'm the teddy bear gathering dust bunnies under the bed, not the one-legged soldier.
He smiles slightly and sips his rapidly cooling coffee. She's back to dancing. However disconcerting Edison might find it, Victor's on familiar ground.
In what way?
Sometimes you can look at a wedding and realize with a certain sense of resignation that any children produced in that marriage will inevitably be fucked up and fucked over. It's a fact. Not a sense of foreboding so much as a grim acceptance that these two people should not, but definitely will, reproduce. Like my parents. My mother was 22 when she married my father. He was her third marriage. The first was when she was 17 and married the brother of her mother's then-current husband. He died in less than a year from a heart attack during sex. He left her pretty well off, so a few months later she married a man only 15 years older than her. And when they divorced a year later, she came off even a little better. Then came my dad, and if he hadn't knocked her up, I doubt the wedding would have happened. He was good-looking, but he wasn't wealthy, and he didn't have prospects, and he was only 2 years older, which to my mother was an insurmountable series of obstacles. For that, we can thank her mother, who had 9 husbands before early menopause made her decide she was too dried up to remarry. And every single one of them died, each faster than the one before. No foul play about it either, just died. Most of them were ancient, of course, and all of them left her with a tidy sum of money. But my mother was raised with certain expectations, and her third husband met none of them. I will say this for them, though, they gave it a try. For the first couple of years, we lived near his family, and there were cousins and aunts and uncles, and I can almost remember playing with other children. Then we moved, and the ties were cut from one end or the other, and it was just me and my parents and their various affairs. They were always either visiting their latest lovers or holing up in their bedrooms, so I became a pretty self-sufficient kid. I learned how to use the microwave, I memorized the bus schedule so I could get to the grocery store, I staked out the days of the week when either of my parents were likely to have cash in their wallets so I could actually buy things at the market. And you'd think that would look strange, right? But whenever anyone at the store asked, a concerned woman, a cashier, I'd say my mom was out in the car with the baby, keeping the air running. Even in winter, they believed that, and they'd smile and tell me what a wonderful daughter and sister I was. So not only was I self-sufficient, I came to have a pretty low opinion of most people's intelligence. I was 6 when they decided to give marriage counseling a go. Not a try, a go. Someone at my dad's office told him insurance would cover counseling, and counseling looked better with a judge and helped speed up a divorce. One of the things the counselor told them to do was take a family trip, just the 3 of us, somewhere fun and special. A theme park, maybe. We got to the park around 10, and for the first couple of hours things went okay. Then the carousel. I fucking hate carousels. My dad stood at the exit to wait for me to come off. My mom stood at the entrance to help me get on. And they just stood there, on opposite sides of the thing, and watched me go round and round in circles. I was too small to reach for the iron rings, and the horse I was on was so wide it made my hips hurt. But round and round and round I went. And I watched my father walk away with a petite Latina. Another time around, and I saw my mother leave with a tall, laughing ginger in a utility kilt. A nice older kid helped me down off the horse after he lifted his little sister down, and held my hand as we walked to the exit. I wanted to stay with that family, to be the little sister of someone who went on rides with you and held your hand while walking. Someone who smiled down and asked if you had fun. But we got outside the carousel, and I thanked him, waving at a woman paying attention to nothing but her cell phone, so the boy thought I'd found my mom. And I watched him and his sister walk back to parents who were delighted to see them. I spent the rest of the day wandering around the park, trying not to get noticed by security. But sunset came and the park closed, and I still hadn't found either of my parents. Security noticed and hauled me off to the Hall of Shame. Well, they called it the Lost Parents Place. They cycled a list of calls over the PA system, asking parents missing their children to come claim them. There were others there, too, other kids who'd been forgotten or just wandered away or had been hiding. Then I heard one of the adults mention child services. Specifically, she mentioned calling child services for anyone who wasn't claimed before 10 o'clock. My next-door neighbors were a foster home, and the thought of living with people like them was horrific. Fortunately, one of the younger kids pissed himself and sent up such a squall that all the adults started fussing over him, trying to calm him. And I managed to sneak out the door and back into the park. It took some searching, but I finally found the main gate and got out without being seen, attaching myself to the rear of a school group that had gotten stuck for a while on one of the rides and out into the parking lot. From there, it took over an hour for me to walk through all the parking lots to a gas station that was still brightly lit for all the folks heading home. I still had most of the snack money my dad had shoved in my pocket before the carousel, so I called their cell phones, and then I called the house phone. And then because I couldn't think of anything else to do, I called my next-door neighbor. It was almost 10 o'clock at night, but he hopped in the car and drove 2 hours to come pick me up, and another 2 hours home. And there were no lights on at all in my house.
Was this the neighbor who was a foster father? Victor asks when she pauses to lick her chapped lips. He reaches for the empty bottle of water and holds it up toward the one-way mirror, not putting it down until one of the techs says Edison is on his way.
Yes.
But he got you safely home. So why was the thought of living with him so horrific?
When we pulled up in front of his house, he told me I needed to thank him for the ride by licking his lollipop.
The plastic bottle shrieks a protest as it crumples in his fist. Christ.
When he pulled my head toward his lap, I stuck a finger down my throat and made myself throw up all over him. Made sure to hit the horn, too, so his wife would come out.
She opens another sugar packet and tips half of it into her mouth.
He got arrested for molestation a month or so later, and she moved away.
The door slams open, and Edison tosses a new bottle of water at the girl. Protocol says they're supposed to remove the cap for them, choking hazard, but his other hand is occupied with a sheaf of photo papers that he drops onto the table, along with a bag of IDs in the crook of his elbow.
By not telling us the truth, he snarls, you're protecting the man who did this.
Inara was right. It is different seeing it than just reading about it. Victor lets out a slow breath, using it to push down the instinctive revulsion. He shifts the first picture off the pile, then the second, the third, the fourth, all depicting portions of the hallways in the ruined garden complex. She stops him at the seventh one, easing the paper away so she can look at it more closely. When she sets it back down on top, her finger pets a tawny curve near the center of the image.
That's Lionette.
Your friend. Her bandaged finger gently moves along the line of glass in the picture.
Yeah, she whispers. She was.
Birthdays, like names, were best forgotten in the garden. As I got to know the other girls, I knew they were all fairly young, but ages weren't something you asked about. It just didn't seem necessary. At some point we'd die, and the hallways provided daily reminders of what that would mean. So why compound the tragedy? Until Lionette. I'd been in the garden for 6 months, and while I'd become friendly with most of the other girls, I was closest to Lionette and Bliss. They were the most like me, the ones who really didn't feel up to the high drama of weeping or bemoaning our inevitably tragic fates. We didn't cower before the gardener. We didn't suck up to him like becoming favorites would somehow change our fortunes. We were the ones who put up with what we had to and otherwise did our own thing. The gardener adored us. Except for meals, which were served at specific times, there was never a place we had to be, so most of the girls room-hopped for comfort. If the gardener wanted you, he'd simply check the cameras and come find you. When Lionette asked Bliss and me to spend the night in her room, I didn't think anything of it. It was something we did all the time. I should have recognized the desperation in her voice, the edge to her words. But that was something else the garden numbed you to. Like beauty, desperation and fear were as common as breathing. We were provided with clothing for the daytime, always in black, always things that left our backs bare so the wings could be seen. But we're given nothing for sleeping. Most of us just slept in our underwear and wished for bras, The hostel and the apartment had been good practice for me. I had far less modesty than most of the other girls had had coming into the garden. One less humiliation that might break me. The three of us curled together atop the mattress, waiting for the lights to go out. And gradually we became aware that Lionette was shaking. Not like a seizure or anything, just a tremor that ran under her skin and electrified every part of her with movement. I sat up, reaching for her hand to lace our fingers together. What's wrong? Tears gleamed in her gold-flecked eyes, making me suddenly nauseated. I'd never seen Lionette cry before. She hated tears in anyone, especially herself.
Tomorrow's my 21st birthday, she whispered.
Bliss squeaked and threw her arms around our friend, burying her face in Lionette's shoulder.
Fuck, Lion, I'm so sorry.
We have an expiration date, then? I asked quietly. 21. Lionette clutched Bliss and me with desperate strength.
I can't decide if I should fight or not. I'm going to die anyway, and I kind of want to make him earn it. But what if fighting makes it more painful? Shit, I feel like such a coward, but if I have to die, I don't want it to hurt.
She started sobbing, and I wished this was one of the times the solid walls came down around the glass, so we could be trapped in this little space, and her weeping wouldn't be heard by everyone down the hall. Lionette had a reputation for strength among the girls, and I didn't want them to think her weak once she was gone. But, for the most part, the walls only came down two mornings a week, what we'd taken to calling the weekend, whether it was or not, so the actual gardeners could do maintenance around our beautiful prison. The hired help never saw us, and the multiple sets of closed doors between us and them guaranteed they never heard us either. No, wait. The walls came down when a new girl was brought in, too. Or when one died. We didn't like it when the walls came down. Wishing they would was kind of extraordinary. We stayed with Lionette the entire night, long after she'd wept herself into an exhausted sleep and had woken only to weep again. Around 4, she roused enough to stumble into the shower, and we helped her wash her hair, brushed it out, and arranged it in a regal braided crown. There was a new dress in her closet, an amber silk fancy with glimmering gold threads that was bright as a flame against all the black. The color made her wings glow against her light brown skin, brilliant pumpkin orange flecked with gold and yellow closest to the black spots, and the white-fringed bands of black on the very tips. The open wings of a lustrous copper. The gardener came for her just before daylight. He was an elegant figure of a man, maybe a little above average height, well-built. The type of man who always looked at least 10 to 15 years younger than he really was. Dark blonde hair, always perfectly in place and well-trimmed, pale green eyes like the sea. He was handsome, that couldn't be argued, even if my stomach still turned at the sight of him. I'd never seen him dressed all in black before. He stood in the doorway, thumbs hooked in his pockets, and just looked at us. Taking a deep breath, Lionette hugged Bliss tightly, whispered something in her ear before kissing her goodbye. Then she turned to me, her arms painfully tight around my ribs.
"My name is Cassidy Lawrence," she whispered, so quietly I could barely hear it. "Please don't forget me. Don't let him be the only one to remember me."
She kissed me, closed her eyes, and allowed the gardener to lead her away. Bliss and I spent the rest of the morning in Lionette's room going through the small personal items she'd managed to accumulate over the past 5 years. 5 years she'd been there. We took down the privacy curtains, folded them together with the bedding into a neat stack on the edge of the naked mattress. The book she kept under her pillows turned out to be the Bible, with 5 years of rage and despair and hope scrawled around the verses. There were enough origami animals for all the girls in the garden, and then some. So we spent the afternoon giving them away, along with the black clothing. When we sat down to dinner, there was nothing left of Lionette in the room. That night the walls came down. Bliss and I curled together in my bed, which actually had more bedding than a sewn-on sheet now. Personal touches were things we earned by not being troublesome, by not trying to kill ourselves, so I had sheets and blankets now, the same rich rose and purple as the lower wings on my back. Bliss cried and swore when the walls came down and trapped us in the room. They rose after a few hours, and before they'd come higher than a foot off the floor, she grabbed my hand and squeezed us through so we could search the hallways. But we only had to go a few feet. The gardener stood there, leaning back against the garden side wall as he studied the girl in the glass. Her head was bowed nearly against her chest, small stirrups under her armpits keeping her upright. Clear resin filled the rest of the space, the gown caught in the liquid like she was underwater. We could see almost every detail of the bright wings on her back, nearly pressed against the glass. Everything that was Lionette, her fierce smile, her eyes, was hidden away, so the wings were the only focus. He turned to us and ran a hand through my sleep-tangled hair, gently tugging through the knots he encountered.
"You forgot to put your hair up, Maya. I can't see your wings."
I started to gather it, to twist into a rough knot, but he caught my wrist and pulled me after him. Into my room. Bliss swore and ran down the hall, but not before I saw her tears. The gardener sat on my bed and brushed my hair until it gleamed like silk, running his fingers through it again and again. Then his hands moved elsewhere, and his mouth, and I closed my eyes and silently recited the Valley of Unrest.
"Wait, what?" Edison interrupts, a sickened expression on his face. She looks away from the picture, giving him a bemused look.
"The Valley of Unrest," she repeats. "It's a poem by Edgar Allan Poe. They had gone unto the wars, trusting to the mild-eyed stars nightly from their azure towers to keep watch above the flowers. I like Poe. There's something refreshing about a man who's so unabashedly morose."
"But what?"
"It's what I did whenever the gardener came to my room," she says baldly. "I wasn't going to fight him, because I didn't want to die, but I wasn't going to participate either. So I let him do his thing, and to keep my mind occupied, I recited Poe's poems."
"The day he finished your tattoo, was that the first time,
I recited Poe?"
She finishes for him, one eyebrow arched mockingly. Victor flushes but nods.
"No, thank God. I'd gotten curious about sex a few months before, so Hope loaned me one of her boys, sort of."
Edison makes a choking sound, and Victor can't help but be grateful that his wife has these kinds of discussions with their daughters.
In any other setting, we probably would have called Hope a whore, except that Sophia, who actually had been a prostitute until her daughters were taken away by the cops, was a little sensitive about words like that. Plus, Hope was in it for the fun, not the money. She could have made a fortune, though. Male, female, pairs, trios, or groups, Hope was up for anything. And there really wasn't any such thing as privacy in the apartment. Except for the bathroom, it was all one room, after all, and the curtains between the beds weren't thick enough to conceal much. No canopies, anyway. They certainly didn't make anything soundproof. Hope and Jessica weren't the only girls to bring people home, but they did it with the most frequency. Sometimes more than once in a day. Early exposure, no pun intended, to pedophiles had left me mostly uninterested in sex. That plus my parents. It seemed a horrific business, not one I wanted any part of. But living with the girls gradually changed that. When they weren't doing it, they were frequently talking about it. And even when they laughed at me, they answered silly questions about it. Or, in Hope's case, decided to demonstrate how to masturbate. So eventually curiosity won out over the distaste, and I decided to give it a try. Well, I decided to think about giving it a try. I backed away from a lot of opportunities at first because I still wasn't sure. Then one afternoon, when I didn't have to go into work in the evening, Hope came home trailing two boys. Jason we worked with, one of the few males on the overwhelmingly female wait staff, and his friend, Topher, was a pretty standard fixture in the apartment. They frequently dropped by, whether Hope was there or not. We thought they were fun to hang out with. Sometimes they brought food. The three were barely in the door before Hope was busy pulling off Jason's clothing, and the two of them were completely naked by the time they tumbled laughing through the curtains onto her bed. Topher at least had the grace to blush and kick the trail of clothing closer to the bed. I was on one of the couches with a book. One of the first things I did once I had a real address was to get a library card, and I made a couple trips a week. Reading had been an escape when I was younger, and even though I didn't have anything I particularly needed to escape from anymore, it was still something I loved. When the clothing was more or less contained, Topher poured two glasses of orange juice. Social services had swung by a couple of days ago, so the fridge was actually stocked, and handed one of them to me as he flopped next to me on the couch. "What, not joining them?" I teased, and his blush deepened.
"It's no mystery that being with Hope is a little like having a timeshare, but I don't share at the same time,"
he mumbled, and I snickered. Hope was exactly like a timeshare, and proud of it. Topher was a model, maybe 19, who sometimes helped Julian with the deliveries to make a few extra bucks. He was good-looking in that bland model way, you know, the kind of good-looking that seems really ordinary because it's shoved in your face all the time. He was a decent guy, though. We talked about the matinee a whole slew of us had gone to see the week before, about a gig he had for a few days as a living dummy for a temporary museum exhibit, about one of our mutual acquaintances getting married and whether or not it would last, all while Hope and Jason went at it screaming and giggling. So pretty much a normal afternoon. Eventually, though, their fun had to end. "It's almost 4 o'clock, I yelled over the groaning. "You two need to get to work."
"Okay, I'll finish him off."
True to her word, she had Jason grunting in less than 30 seconds, and 10 minutes later, they'd both had a quick rinse in the shower and were off to work. Most of the girls were working that night, except for Noemi and Amber, who both had a night class on Wednesdays and wouldn't be back until almost 10. Topher left for a little while, but came back with takeout from Takis on the corner. I knew Hope's usual invitation to sex was to kiss someone and shove her hand down his or her pants. But I wasn't Hope. "Hey, Topher?"
"Yeah?"
"Do you want to teach me about sex?" I was a different kind of straightforward. Anyone else probably would have blanched, but Topher was a friend of Hope's. Plus, he'd been there for some of the conversations. All he did was smile, and I was reassured by the fact that it wasn't a smirk.
"Sure, if you think you're ready for it."
"I think so. I mean, we can always stop."
"Yes, we can. Just tell me if you get uncomfortable, okay?"
"Okay." He took the remains of our dinner and shoved them into the overflowing trash can by the door. Hope was supposed to take it out when she left for work. When he came back to the couches, he dropped down onto the cushion and gently pulled me to lean against him.
"We'll start slow," he said.
And he kissed me. We didn't actually have sex that night. He called it everything but. It was comfortable, though, and fun, and we laughed as much as anything, which in itself would have been strange just a year before when I'd first moved in. We kept the clothes on after Noemi and Amber came home from class, but he stayed with me that night in my narrow bed, and we played more under the sheets until Noemi, in the next bed over, laughed and said if we didn't shut up, she was going to join us. It was a few days later that we had the privacy to go all the way. And the first time, I didn't really understand what the big deal was. Then we did it again, and that time I did. We spent the next few weeks fooling around, until he met a girl at church he wanted to be serious with. But as easily as we'd become friends with benefits, we went back to being friends, without any awkwardness or hurt feelings at all. Neither of us had fallen for the other, neither of us was putting more into it than the other. I loved when he came by the apartment, but not because I expected sex after he started dating his church girl. Topher was just a good guy, someone we all adored. It did not, however, make me understand my parents' fascination with sex to the exclusion of all else.
She unscrews the cap and takes a long drink of water, rubbing at her sore throat as she swallows. Victor is grateful for the silence and thinks Edison must be as well, both men staring at the table. Trauma being what it is, Victor can't recall a victim interview where sex was such a frank topic. He clears his throat, turning the photos over so he doesn't have to see the hallways lined with dead girls in glass and resin. Your next-door neighbor when you were a child was a pedophile, you said. But when did you see the others? Grand's lawn guy. She stops, blinks, and glowers at the bottle of water, and Victor can't help but think she didn't mean to say it. Perhaps the exhaustion is setting in with a stronger grip. He files that thought away for now, but he'll watch for other opportunities. You saw your gran often? She sighs and picks at a scab on one of her fingers.
I lived with her,
she answers reluctantly. When was this?
My parents finally got divorced when I was 8. All the questions about money, about the house and cars and all the things were taken care of in one meeting. The next 8 months were spent with each arguing that the other should be stuck with me. Isn't that fantastic? Every kid should be forced to sit through 8 months of listening to their parents actively not want them. Eventually, it was decided that I'd be sent to live with Gran, my mother's mother, and both my parents would pay her child support. When the day came for me to leave, I sat on my front step with 3 suitcases, 2 boxes, and a teddy bear, the grand total of everything I owned. Neither of my parents was home. A year before, we'd gotten new neighbors across the street, a youngish couple who'd just had their first child. I used to love going over to see the baby, a beautiful little boy who wasn't broken or fucked up yet. With parents like his, maybe he never would be. She'd always give me a plate of cookies and a glass of milk, and he taught me how to play poker and blackjack. They were the ones who took me to the bus station, who helped me buy my ticket with the money my parents had left on my nightstand the day before, the ones who helped me load everything under the bus and introduce me to the driver and help me find a seat. She even gave me a lunch for the trip, complete with oatmeal raisin cookies still warm from the oven. They were another family I wished I could be a part of, but I wasn't theirs. Still, I waved goodbye to them as the bus pulled away, and they stood together on the curb, their baby held between them, and waved until we couldn't see each other anymore. When I got to the city where Gran lived, I had to take a taxi from the bus station to the house. The driver swore all the way there about people who had no business having kids, and when I asked him what some of the words meant, he even taught me how to use them in sentences. My gran lived in a big, dilapidated house in a neighborhood that was moneyed 60 years ago but quickly went to shit, and when the driver had helped me unload everything onto her tiny front porch, I paid him and told him to have a great fucking day. He laughed and tugged my braid, told me to take care of myself. Menopause did strange things to Gran. She was a serial bride and widow when she was younger, but that time convinced her she was dried up and halfway into the grave, so she holed up in her house and started filling all the rooms and halls with dead things. No, seriously, with dead things. Even the taxidermists thought she was creepy, and you have to be really fucking bad to win that award. She had things she'd purchased pre-made, like wild game or exotics, things like bears and mountain lions that weren't something you saw in a city. She had birds and armadillos and, my personal most hated, the collection of neighborhood cats and dogs that had been killed in various ways over the years that she'd taken in to be stuffed. They were everywhere, even in the bathrooms and kitchen, and they filled every single room. When I walked in, dragging my things behind me into the entryway, she was nowhere to be seen. I heard her, though. "If you're a rapist, I'm all dried up. Don't waste your time.
If you're a thief, I have nothing worth stealing. And if you're a murderer, shame on you!
I followed the sound of her voice and finally found her in a small family room with narrow walkways between all the stacks of stuffed animals. She was in an easy chair wearing a full-body tiger print unitard and a dark brown fur coat, chain-smoking as she watched The Price is Right on a 7-inch television whose picture wavered and frequently fell to discoloration. She didn't even look at me until the commercials.
Oh, you're here. Upstairs, third door on the right. Be a good girl and bring me the bottle of whiskey on the counter before you go.
I got it for her. Why not? And watched, in amazement, as she poured the entire bottle into small dishes and bowls in front of the dead cats and dogs lined up on a couch that would have been hideous under the best of circumstances.
Drink up, my beauties. Being dead is no treat. You've earned it.
Whiskey fumes quickly filled the room, joining with the musty scent of fur and stale cigarettes. Upstairs, third door on the right, led into a room full of so many dead animals they tumbled out when I opened the door. I spent the rest of that day and all that night hauling them out and finding places to stick them so I could bring up my things. I slept, curled up on top of the biggest suitcase because the sheets were so gross. I spent the next day cleaning the room top to bottom, beating the dust and mouse droppings and mouse corpses out of the mattress, and putting my own sheets from home on the bed. When I had everything arranged as close to home as I could manage, I went back downstairs. The only indication Gran had moved was her unitard, now a bright, shiny purple. I waited until the commercials, and then cleared my throat. "I've cleaned out the room," I told her. "If you put any more dead things in there while I'm living here, I'll burn the house down." She laughed and slapped me.
"Good girl. I like your gumption."
And that was moving in with my gran. The setting changed, but life didn't. She had her groceries delivered once a week by a nervous-looking boy who got a tip almost as big as the grocery bill, purely because that was the only way he'd come to our neighborhood. It was pretty simple to call the grocery store and have new things added to the staples. I was enrolled in a school that taught absolutely nothing, where the teachers wouldn't even take attendance because they didn't want truancy to stick them with these kids for another year. There were supposed to be some really good teachers in the school, but they were few and far between, and I never got any of them. The rest were burned out and just didn't care anymore as long as they got a paycheck. The students certainly encouraged that. Drug deals went down right there in the classrooms, even in the elementary school, on behalf of older siblings. When I went up into the middle school, there were metal detectors on every outer door, but no one gave a shit or investigated when they went off, which was frequently. No one noticed if you weren't in class, no one called home to check up on students who'd been gone for several days in a row. I tested that once, stayed home for a full week. I didn't even get makeup work when I went back. I only returned because I was bored. Sad, really. I left everyone else alone, so they left me alone, too. I didn't leave the house after dark, and every night I fell asleep to a lullaby of gunshots and sirens. And when Gran's lawn guy came twice a month, I hid under my bed in case he came into the house. He was probably in his late 20s, maybe a little older, and always wore jeans that were too tight and too low, trying to make the best of a package that even at that age I didn't think was very impressive. He liked to call me pretty girly, and if he was there when I came home from school, he'd try to touch me and ask me to bring him things. I kicked him once, right in the balls, and he cursed and chased me into the house, but he tripped over the stag in the entryway, and Gran ripped him a new one for making too much noise during her soaps. After that, I hung out at the gas station a few blocks over until I saw his truck drive past.
And your parents never questioned your well-being? He knows it's a stupid question, but it's already out of his mouth, and he nods even as her mouth twists.
My parents never came to see me, never called, never sent cards or gifts or anything. Mom sent checks for the first 3 months, Dad for the first 5, but then those stopped too. I never saw my parents or heard from them again
after I went to Grand's. I honestly don't even know if they're still alive. They've been at this all day. The birthday cake, the first thing he'd had since last night's dinner. He can feel his stomach complaining, knows she must be at least as hungry. It's been almost 24 hours since the FBI arrived at the garden. They've both been awake longer than that. Inara, I'm willing to let you tell things in your own way, but I need you to give me a straightforward answer to one question. Should we have child services in here?
No,
she says immediately. And that's the truth. How close is that truth to a lie? It's actually a smile this time, crooked and wry, but even so small a smile as that softens her entire face.
I turned 18 yesterday. Happy birthday to me.
You were 14 when you got to New York? Edison demands.
Yep.
What the hell?
Gran died.
She shrugs, reaching for the water bottle.
I came home from school, and she was dead in the chair with burns on her fingers where the cigarette burned all the way down. I'm kind of amazed the whole damn place wasn't on fire from the whiskey fumes. I think her heart gave out or something.
Did you report it?
No. The lawn guy or the grocery boy would find her when they went to get paid, and I didn't want anyone arguing about what to do with me. Maybe they would have tracked down one of my parents and I'd be forced to go with them, or they'd just dump me into the system. Or maybe they would have tracked down one of those uncles or aunts on my dad's side and shoved me off onto yet another relative who didn't want me. I didn't like those options.
So what'd you do?
I packed a suitcase and a duffel, then raided Grand's stash.
Victor's not sure if he's going to regret the answer, but he has to ask. Stash?
Of cash. Gran only sort of trusted banks, so any time she got a check, she cashed it and hid half of it up the German Shepherd's ass. The tail was on a hinge, so you could reach under and pull out the money.
She takes a sip, then purses her lips and presses them against the mouth of the bottle, letting the water soak against the chapped cracks.
There was almost 10 grand in there,
she continues when she pulls the bottle away.
I hid it away in my suitcase and duffel, spent the night at the house, and in the morning I woke up and walked down to the bus station rather than school and bought a ticket to New York.
You spent the night in the house with your dead grandmother.
She wasn't stuffed yet, but otherwise, what was the difference than any other night?
He's grateful for the static in his ear.
We ordered food for the three of you,
Yvonne reports from the observation room. Couple more minutes on it, and Ramirez called. A few of the girls have started talking. Not much yet. They seem more concerned with the dead ones than themselves. Senator Kingsley is on her way from Massachusetts.
Well, it started out as good news. It's probably too much to hope that the senator will be forced to make an early landing somewhere due to bad weather.
Victor shakes his head and leans back in his chair. The senator isn't here yet. They'll deal with her once she is.
We're going to take a break soon so we can all eat, but one more question before that.
Only one?
Tell us about how you came to the garden.
That isn't a question.
Edison slaps his thigh impatiently, but it's still Victor who speaks.
How did you come to the garden?
I was kidnapped.
Three teenage daughters, and he can practically hear the unspoken, duh, at the end of it. Inara.
You're really good at that.
Please. She sighs and brings her feet up onto the edge of the chair, wrapping her bandaged hands around her ankles.
Evening Star was a pretty nice restaurant. Reservation only, unless it was a slow night. But the prices were high enough that most people wouldn't just walk off the street for a meal. On normal nights, the waiters wore tuxedos, and the waitresses black strapless gowns with standalone collars and cuffs like the tuxes. We even had black bow ties that were a bitch and a half to get right. We weren't allowed clip-ons. Julian knew how to cater to the stupidly rich, though, so you could actually rent out the entire restaurant for special occasions and put the waitstaff in costumes. There were a few basic rules. He drew the line at indecency. But within a fairly broad range of options, you could provide the costumes, and we would wear them for the event. And then got to keep them. He always gave us warnings about the costumes, so we could trade shifts if we didn't think we could deal with it. 2 weeks before my 16th birthday, or as far as the girls knew, my 21st, the restaurant got rented out by someone doing a fundraiser for one of the theaters. Their first show was going to be a production of Madame Butterfly, so we were dressed accordingly. Only girls were allowed to work this one by request of the client, and we were all given black dresses that came high around a pair of huge wire and silk wings that stayed on with spirit gum and latex. Fuck, what a process that was. And we all had to wear our hair completely up. We all agreed it was better than the shepherdess fetish costumes, or the Civil War-themed wedding rehearsal dinner that stuck us all with hoop skirts that we'd finally converted to Christmas light chandeliers when we got sick of them taking up an entire corner of the apartment. Even if it meant getting to work hours early so we could put the damn wings on, the rest of it wasn't that bad, and we could all use the dresses again. Trying to wait tables with large wings behind you was a clusterfuck, though, and by the time the main course had been served, and we could retreat to the kitchen during the fundraising presentation, most of us didn't know whether to swear or laugh. A number of us were doing both. Rebecca, our lead hostess, sighed and sank down on a stool, propping her feet up on a sideways crate. Her pregnancy had finally made high heels impossible and had also spared her from having to bear the indignity of wings.
"This thing needs to come out of me now," she groaned.
I squeezed behind the stool as best I could with the wings and started massaging her tight shoulders and back. Hope peeked out through a gap in the swinging doorway.
"Anyone else think the guy in charge is totally fuckable for an old man?"
"He's not that old, and watch your mouth," Whitney retorted.
There were certain words Julian preferred we didn't use at work, even in the kitchens, and fuck was one of them.
"Well, his son looks older than me, so he is an old man."
"Then ogle the son."
"No thanks. He's hot, but there's something wrong with him."
"He isn't looking at you?"
"He's looking a lot at a bunch of us. He's just wrong. I'd rather I fuck the old man." We stayed in the kitchen, chatting and making up gossip about the guests, until the presentation's intermission, when we circulated with refills and bottles of wine and dessert trays. At the host's table, I got a good look at Hope's old man and his son. Right away, I knew what she meant about the son. He was handsome, well-muscled and good-featured, with dark brown eyes and his father's dark blonde hair, which looked good against his tanned skin, even if the tan looked a little fake. It was something deeper than that, though, a cruelty that showed through in his otherwise charming smile, the way he watched all of us as we moved through the room. Next to him, his father was simply charming, with an easy smile that thanked us all wordlessly for our efforts. He stopped me with two fingers against my wrist. Not too familiar. Not threatening.
"That's a lovely tattoo, my dear."
I glanced down to the slit in my skirt. All of us in the apartment, even Catherine, had gone out together and gotten matching tattoos a few months before, something we still found absurd and couldn't quite figure out why we'd done it, except that most of us had been a bit tipsy and Hope nagged us until we gave in. It was on the outside of my right ankle, just above the bone, and it was an elegant thing of sweeping black lines. Hope had picked it out. Sophia, the other sober one, argued against the butterfly because it was overdone and so damn typical. But Hope didn't budge. She was a freaking honey badger when she wanted to be. She called it a tribal butterfly. Normally we had to keep tattoos covered up with clothing or makeup for work, but because of the event theme, Julian had said we could leave them uncovered.
"Thank you."
I poured the sparkling wine into his glass.
"Are you fond of butterflies?"
Not particularly, but that didn't seem a bright thing to mention given the theme of his party. They're beautiful.
Yes, but like most beautiful creatures, very short-lived.
His pale green eyes.